Ron is Al-Anon's Northern California delegate, and what we've decided to do is John will speak for 40, 45 minutes, whatever feels right for you, John, and then we're going to have a Q&A. And how the Q&A is going to work is if anybody on Zoom has a question, please put it in the chat. We have our tech people here that'll take it from the chat and put it on a tablet so that we'll be able to read those questions. And then for those of you in the room, Kathleen's got some 3x5 cards. If you have a question, she'll hand those out. And you know, without further ado, John, let's welcome John.
Water there for you. Yeah, I love it.
Yes.
How does that sound? Is that good audio? All right. Hi, my name is John, and I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. And thank you, Owen, for inviting me to share experience, strength, and hope with you and the members here in District 14. One of my jobs as delegate is to visit each of the 27 districts in Northern California. And this is an opportunity to do that. So that's what the thought about questions is afterwards. It's an opportunity for the members of District 14 to ask questions, to share feedback. My job as delegate is to represent the groups of Northern California at the conference. And if I do not meet with you and talk with you and hear you,
can't hear you, speak up.
Then I'm not able to fully really do my job. I'm getting a little bit of feedback from this. I'm going to try switching to the microphone because I think that's going to interfere. Ready to hear. How's that? No?
It says it's on. Oh, there we go. Okay. So, what it used to be like and what happened that got me here and what it's like now. I grew up in San Francisco. I have a mom and a dad, and I have an older sister and a younger sister. And it was the Gaelic garlic combo. Are you familiar with the Irish Italian mix? It's a very combustible mix. And you know, my family tried really hard to look normal on the outside. My mom worked very hard to make sure that everything looked good. And both of my parents drank every day. My dad would become the identified alcoholic in our family. There's a lot of alcoholism all over the Irish side of the family, and a lot of not talking about the problems of alcohol and on the Italian side. And so I think when I, as far back as I can remember, probably when I was 5 years old, I knew that I was gay. And I believed that my father didn't like that. It felt like he was disappointed and that he wanted a different son. And that hurt. And the way that I dealt with that pain was I pushed him away. I rejected him. And alcoholics give us lots of convenient excuses to push them away. And my dad's behavior made it very easy for me to judge him. And I did that. And as the years went by, my dad was a Jekyll and Hyde drinker. So some nights he would pass out on the couch And that was a good night. And some nights the dinner plates would fly off the table and he'd throw the food on the floor and scream and yell. And I never knew when that was going to happen or what was going to cause it. And so that created, you know, a lot of anxiety in me, a lot of trying to anticipate the future and worrying. And my because of all of that, my house felt like an unsafe place. And I would see my dad passed out on the couch, and it was obvious to me that he was drunk. And I would look at my mom with so much anger and so much judgment. And I would think, and what is your excuse? When are you going to get us out of here? When are you going to leave him? I was convinced that that would be a solution to my problem. And, but she didn't leave. So it was my goal to get out of the house. And I went away to college. But in my third year, I got a call from my older sister. And she said, you need to come back. Mom is tired of dad's drinking. She's going to do an intervention and you need to be here. And so we had never said the word alcoholism in our house, not one time. We certainly didn't talk to him about his drinking. And we did not talk with each other, the four of us, my mom and my two sisters and I. So I thought, okay, we're going to confront him as a family about his drinking. I want to see what that's going to look like. Sign me up. I'm there. And it was awful. I hated it. I hated watching my younger sister, who was 13 at the time, shaking and crying, and her little chin was quivering. It was so hard for her to say those words about how his drinking was affecting her. And I just sat there looking at my dad like, can't you see? Can't you see what your drinking is doing to our family? Why can't you just stop? And I didn't understand then that alcoholics are just people who have lost the ability to choose. And we were trying to force him to make a choice, stop drinking or move out. And his alcoholism wasn't going to allow that choice. So when we were done, he stood up and he said, are you finished? And we said, yes. And he said, good. And he turned around and he walked out of the house. And I never saw my father again after that day. He moved down to Half Moon Bay, where he owned a bar and a restaurant where he sat and he drank all day. He got an apartment down there. And about a year later, my mom walked into my room and she said, I am so sorry to tell you this, but your dad just died. I was shocked. I was waiting for my dad to come home. I was stunned. I was hurt. I was angry. I felt guilt over the intervention. And, you know, grief. The trauma of 20 years of living with this alcoholic situation. And I didn't know how to talk about any of those feelings. And I didn't know how to feel them. And I just took them all and I just stuffed them down. And I told myself a story. And the story was, he's the bad one. I'm the good one. He's the problem. The problem is gone. So my life is going to be better now, right? So that was how I coped. I didn't know about the term family disease of alcoholism. I never heard that until I came to Al-Anon. And I didn't know that I had already been severely affected. I was 20 when we did the intervention. And that year I was diagnosed with HIV. And at 26, I had become disabled with a condition called neuropathy, which affects the nerves in my feet. So it creates a mobility disability. And by 28, I was 5150'd after my second suicide attempt. And I'm still telling myself this story. I'm not affected by his drinking. It's his problem. It's not my problem. But it's getting a lot harder to believe that story. And I decided that I needed someone to love me. And if someone else loved me, then I would love me. And so I did what I think many adult children of alcoholics do. I partnered with an alcoholic. And we loved each other very much. And we built a life together and started a business together. And it was wonderful in the beginning and until it wasn't. I should also say, when after the intervention, I was so angry. I was so angry with my family and especially my mom. And I tried a lot of ways to change my mom, to get her to see what had happened in our family. And she did not want to see things my way. And I think it's been so helpful in our literature. It says, it's not our goal in Al-Anon to be right. And it's not our goal to win. It is our goal to do everything we can to heal ourselves and our relationships. But I didn't know that. I needed to be right. And in an effort to do that, I punished my mom with silence. I walked away from the family. So through my 20s and 30s, I wanted nothing to do with my family. And I partnered with this alcoholic. I don't know he's an alcoholic, and he has depression, and the drinking is getting worse, and now the depression is worse, and now he's not working, and now he's sitting at home all day. And I needed him, it was his job to love me so that I could be okay. And I felt him drifting away, and he's not doing his job, and I found someone else who would love me. And I left and I moved in, and he was an alcoholic too, except his drinking was worse. And his drinking brought me to my knees, and we ended up in couples therapy. And I said, when are we going to talk about his drinking? And she looked at him and she said, do you have a problem with your drinking? And he said, no, I'm good. And she looked at me and she said, it sounds like you're the one with the problem. And she says, I'm going to suggest you go to Al-Anon. And it was not the first time I had heard that suggestion. In fact, that week, four different people who didn't know each other had suggested Al-Anon to me. And I swatted that away like a fly. It was not the solution that I was looking for. I needed him to stop drinking so much so that I could feel like he loved me and I could feel safe. But God was involved in getting me into the doors, because shortly, I think the night after that couples therapy, I came home from work and he was sitting at the kitchen table drunk and crying. And I said, what's happening? And he said, my mom's been arrested and we will have to raise my two teenage stepbrothers. And I said, I don't want to talk about this with you right now. I could see he was drunk and he was very upset, because I think it was bringing up his own abandonment issues from his childhood with his mother's drinking. And he said, no, I want to talk about it now. And he's screaming and yelling in my face. And in those years, I had panic attacks and my anxiety was so bad. I would have panic attacks on a daily basis. I didn't know what they were. I hid them. I didn't talk about them. And because I hid them, they owned me. And so I started having a panic attack, and I hid myself. I locked myself in the bathroom, and he's screaming and yelling, banging on the door. And I can't even hold myself up. I'm leaning against the wall, and I slid down the wall, and I'm sitting on the bathroom floor. I look up at the ceiling, and I realized in that moment, I'm in over my head. I can't fix and help this guy. That was my secret plan, that I would fix him up and get him healthier and get him to stop drinking. And then I would have the person to love me that I needed, so that he was my substance of choice. I needed him to be better so that I could be okay. And I said something, I don't know where it came from spontaneously. I said, I'm in over my head. I need help. And I don't know who I was talking to, because I don't talk to God. but I heard the front door close, so I knew he had left to the bar. So I went upstairs to take a shower, and standing there in the shower, I had a spiritual experience. I had a moment of peace. All the anxiety that I was shaking in, it just evaporated. I felt calm, and I felt clear in the understanding that I was not gonna be able to help fix or change or save this person, that I needed to help and save myself. And that four people who said Al-Anon in the back of my head, I realized I need to go to Al-Anon. And today I know that that was the answer to that prayer of begging for help on the bathroom floor. I didn't recognize it as such at the time, but I did go to my first Al-Anon meeting that next day, and everything changed. The whole dynamic shifted because the isolation that I was living in got broken because you were there. And I didn't know that there were other people who were living with my problem. Shocking. But I really thought I was unique in my problem. And, I got busy right away. I was drowning out there. I was dying out there. And I grabbed onto Al-Anon like a lifeline. I did. I needed it. And I went to meetings, started going to meetings regularly right away. I asked somebody to sponsor me. He said yes. We worked together for the first 9 years. And he just really guided me gently through the steps. And there are some things that I have learned along the way that have been essential to my recovery. And the first one, it's from our literature that says, what a man thinks, that he becomes. My thoughts become things. And my thoughts were focused on negativity, especially in the forms of judgment and criticism of my family, of my partner, and of myself, and of others. And the other thing that really helped me is in our Just for Today bookmark that says, as I give to the world, so the world will give to me. And I see those two spiritual principles as really intertwined. As I give negativity, it's what just keeps showing up in my life. And the problem was, is I was addicted to it and I didn't know how to stop it. But my sponsor said, you don't have to know. You just have to be willing to work the steps, and your higher power will give you the experiences you need. And that is actually what happened. He was right. And one of the first things that happened after I was in Al-Anon 2 years is that I felt a calling to sponsor Alateen. I didn't particularly like kids, but I saw the people who were sponsoring Alateen had something extra that I wanted. And I thought, maybe there's something to that. And what I realized when I started sponsoring is that it's not that I didn't like teens, it's that I was afraid of their judgment because I was a judgmental teen. And what happened, thank God, is that they embraced me and they really, really welcomed me. And after about 9 months of sponsoring, I went to the sponsor R&R, which will be coming up in September here next month. This was in 2011. And they said, are you bringing your teens to NOCAC? And I said, I've heard of that. What is it? And they said, oh, if you're sponsoring Alateen, you have to bring your teens to NOCAC. And I said, tell me about it. And they said, well, it's 200 teens at a hotel and you eat the food that they eat. And I thought, uh-oh. And you stay up until 1 a.m. because that's when they go to bed. And I thought, uh-oh. And they said, you'll have a roommate who you don't know. And I thought, oh no. And they said, and it's at the Holiday Inn in Fresno. And I was like, oh God, all my judgment, all my fear. That's all it was. But I knew that when I got there, I knew this is where I need to be. I'm not supposed to be anyplace else on this earth right now, but at this Holiday Inn in Fresno. And on Friday night, there were two teenage boys were speaking that night. And they just talked about the abuse the physical abuse, the emotional abuse, the disappointments, the broken promises, and it was so hard to listen. It's one thing to sit in an Alateen meeting with 5 or 10 teens. It's another thing to sit in a conference room as big as this with 200 teenagers. It's very powerful. And what happened is all those feelings I stuffed down started pouring out. And the teens basically cracked through my layers of defenses. They broke me open. And what happened that weekend is it triggered my grieving process. I didn't know that's what was happening, but what it looked like was I couldn't stop crying all weekend. I couldn't really stop at all. I woke up Sunday morning with tears in my eyes before I was even awake. And my roommate said, I said, I don't know what's happening. And he says, I think you're grieving. And he said, I'm so jealous because I can't get there. And so I knew that this is important to my recovery. Now, I would always fought the grieving before Al-Anon, but I said to myself, I'm not going to fight it. I'm just going to let it come. And it didn't last forever, but it lasted a couple of years. And each time more and more came up. And what I learned is that grieving doesn't shatter us. It heals us. And I would not have been able to move forward with the rest of my step work if I hadn't have had that experience to get in touch with my grief and feel, go back. When you sit in an Alateen meeting each week, I heard my childhood repeated. And you don't know who's showing up at the meeting each week. So you don't know what you're going to hear. And God's in charge of that. And boy, I heard it all and more. And I needed that because I had built so many layers against all those memories. And I did feel freer and lighter. But I kept sponsoring. I sponsored Alateen for 9 years. I just loved the teens and I would do anything, I would do anything for them. And because I went into Alateen thinking I was going to save them, and they saved me. And that is true. And so in step one, I learned it's important to ask myself, where is my focus? Admitting powerlessness is hard, especially when you don't have a God yet, because it's essentially admitting that my belief system that I stand on is faulty. And so what then do I have to stand on? And in step two, I learned to ask myself, do I believe that change is possible for me? Isn't that what hope is? Believing that change is possible. And in step three, I found my own higher power. In step two, when I was new in Al-Anon, I called an old timer and I was complaining about the alcoholic, and his response stunned me because it didn't seem to be an answer to my question. But he said, John, many of us have found a higher power here. And I believe you have your own higher power and that he knows what's best for you. And do you know what? I believed him. After years of listening to religious people that I couldn't believe, I believed him because I wasn't paying him. He had no vested interest in my belief. And he was just another person affected by alcoholism like me. That's tradition 8. He was not a professional. He carried the message to me. And so I became willing. Step three was confusing at first, but what I realized is I just need to be willing to turn my will and life over to the care, loving care of my higher power each day. And what is my will? My will is my thoughts and my feelings, and my life is my actions. And step four, I like in our literature, it says, the only person who can love me the way I need to be loved is me. I needed to stop putting the cart before the horse. I kept looking for other people to love me. And I didn't know it's an inside job. My sponsor said, John, it's an inside job. You're looking outside. And, but it also says in our literature that to learn to love myself, I must be willing to learn who I am. And that's what step four gave me, the opportunity to learn about who I am, the person that God made and the person that I had become through the effects of alcoholism. And so I collected, you know, a lot of fear, a lot of resentment. I was able to get free of that resentment towards my dad and the one towards my mom. And when it came time for step five, I was working with the woman who was my service sponsor at the time. She would become my sponsor when my first sponsor moved to Europe. And I asked her if I could do the fifth step with her. She lives in the middle of the Rockies in Colorado, and she drove 6 hours round trip down to the Denver airport and drove me back up. And as we were driving up the mountain, she said, do you want to start the fifth step? I said, where do you begin? And she said, what are the big boulders? And I said, my mom. And she said, what's going on? And I said, I've had this lifetime resentment against her. I blamed her for all my problems. I see now my part in my problems. It was not her fault. I did these things. I created my own suffering. I'm free of the resentment, and she doesn't know. And she said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to talk to her. And she said, great, why don't you? And I said, I'm afraid that if I reach out to her, I'm afraid to reach out to her that she'll reject me. And she said, okay, you're not ready yet. And I said, how do you know? And she said, well, John, you want to tell your mom you love her and you're expecting a specific result? I said, yeah. She said, real love is unconditional. Can you tell your mom that you love her and accept a no? And I said, no. And she said, until you can do that, until you can be willing to accept whatever the outcome is, then just leave it alone for now. And I knew she was right. But miracles happened through the course of that weekend. And the process of us doing the fifth step, she shared a harm that one of her sons had done to her. She's got three kids in her family, just like mine. She has an Irish alcoholic husband, just like mine. They have the same name. Her husband got sober 36 years ago. She got into Al-Anon 46 years ago. And she's telling me about this harm that her son did. And I'm looking at my friend, Nancy, for the first time. I'm looking at her like Nancy, the mom. And I realize in that moment, oh my God, I just owe my mom an amends. I don't have the power to fix a 20-year broken relationship, but I can write a card and tell her I love her and that I'm grateful for everything she's done. And when I got back from Colorado, I wrote the card. It was hard to drop it in the mailbox. I stuck it in the cabinet for many weeks. but God was involved there too. And a dear friend of mine, her mom died, alcoholic father, you know. And when her mom died, she was sobbing. And she said, I never told my mom I loved her. And I didn't want that to be my story too. And it made me willing to let go and let God. And I dropped the card in the mail. And it took a couple of weeks, but I got an email from my mom. And she said, I'd be willing to meet with you for lunch. And that was back in April of 2013. And we've been slowly rebuilding our life together. And it has not been easy. In fact, there were times where I would look at my mom's behavior when I would look at my mom's behavior with a lot of judgment. And I would say to my sponsor, why am I doing this? And she'd say, you don't have to. you can go back to not talking to her. And I say, I already tried that. It doesn't work. And, but I hung in there, and about 5 years ago at Christmas, she says, I turn 80 next year. And I said, Mom, I know your 80th birthday is coming up on June 1st. What do you want to do? And she said, I've already got it handled. I've rented a banquet hall and a microphone. I just want my three children to get up and say nice things about me. And I fell out of my chair. And then I called my sponsor and I said, how am I supposed to do that? How am I supposed to say in front of my entire family nice things about my mom when they all know I didn't talk to her for 20 years? How do I do that and be honest and authentic? And she said, just focus on the positive memories. And I said, I can't think of any. That's the negativity. And she said, then pray for them. And I said, you can do that? And she goes, yeah. And I prayed for them, and you know what, they came. And the first one was that my mom taught me how to ski. We went to Tahoe every year, and she and I skied together for many years. And it was a wonderful memory of my childhood that I conveniently don't want to remember. And I just want to look at the things she didn't do and the things I didn't get and the things that they did wrong. And so I was able to stand in front of like 60 people at my mom's 80th birthday and say all the things that I was grateful for. And they were my truth. And when I was done, I said, you know, and my family doesn't want to hear about Al-Anon. They know I go. They know. They're not interested. And I said, you know, I walked away from my family in anger when my dad died. And I'm so grateful to my mom for what she said when I reached out to her. She said, I never gave up on you. I didn't know that. My head told me every story about what she was thinking. None of them included, she wasn't giving up on me. And so without this program, I wouldn't have had that experience. My two sisters were there. And they never got up and they never said a word. My sponsor said, too bad for them. She said, but you didn't miss that opportunity. And she said, good for you. And I know what that means, you know, it means a lot. But something changed over those 6 months from Christmas to her June 1st birthday when I wrote those positive memories. As I looked at it at the end, I realized this is an inventory. It's an inventory of the good things about my mom. And I realized she's done a lot of good things. And what happened is it shifted my attitude because I realized I've done some good things and some not so good things, just like my mom. I guess that makes us both human. I'm not any different. Didn't I partner with an alcoholic too? And it says in our literature that changed attitudes aid recovery. And what I really have learned is that changed attitudes are so important to my recovery. I can't change my feelings. That's why I came in, because I was so obsessed with how I felt. And I wanted to not feel those bad feelings and only feel safe and good. And Al-Anon said to me, you can't change and control your feelings. But you can change your attitude about your circumstances and your feelings. And that exercise, I think, really, really did that for me, because my interactions with my mom since then have I just, when I go and see her, yes, there's still, I observe my judgments, but I just set them aside. She still drinks every day. She's 84. I've learned that is her business. But it's my business whether I choose to get in the car with her. So I was able to say, you know, mom, are you going to be drinking at lunch today? And she looked at me and she says, I don't drink alcohol during the day. And I said, great. Because for some reason, when I visit, she wants to be the driver. So we drove, we had a great time. And it took me a long time to realize the way I take care of myself is I don't get into the car with someone who's been drinking. I don't tell them not to drink. And recently at Christmas, she shared a secret she's been carrying with her whole life, very hard and painful. And it was just the two of us at that moment. And I was shocked. And but I listened, I learned from sitting like this, sitting, listening. I just listened. And when she was done, I don't know where these words came from. I just said, wow, mom, that must have been so hard to carry all these years. And she said, it was. And I said, do you want a hug? And she goes, yeah, I do. And she's become like my best friend. And she's calling more and emailing more and texting more and inviting me out more. And I think it's really because she doesn't feel judged. And isn't that what we all want? And I know it's what I want, to be accepted for who I am and loved the way I am. And so I continued on with the steps. And step six, what I learned is that I can't remove these defects. I need God. It's all God. I participate by becoming willing, but even that I don't have a lot of control over. I pray each day, this prayer for in step six, I pray, God, please give me the willingness to be entirely ready for you to remove all my defects of character. And do you know what that ends up looking like? It ends up looking like, if I'm struggling with patience, it means that God gives me long lines at the gas station. If I'm struggling with judgment or criticism, it means that God gives me untenable situations where I have to keep my mouth closed. So I know what I'm praying for when I say that prayer. And it's not, don't say that prayer if you don't mean it. And in step seven, I learned that so much of the medicine of this Alan of these 12 steps is in the asking for help. And that's why I don't chase after sponsees or newcomers. They need to be willing to ask for the help they need to get better. And I've learned it's so important. As the sponsor, I always learn more than the sponsored. And that if they need to end it or need to drift away, as some of them do, a friend, a longtime Al-Anon friend, said to me, "Sounds like you dodged a bullet there." And I just remember that, you know, that's God's protection. And I don't know what's right for them. And maybe they're doing whatever is best for their recovery. And as Bob L. used to say, he says, "I put my butterfly net away a long time ago." Yeah. So don't chase after them. I don't chase after them. I think that asking for help is so essential. In step eight, what helped me the most is in PAS, it says, whether my part is 95% or 5%, I'm only making amends for my part. And it, you know, when you have an alcoholic father or an alcoholic partner, it is so tempting to focus on their part, but we don't make amends for their part. We make amends for our part. And in step nine, I think it's really one of the most transformative steps I've ever been through, because when I sat there in front of the alcoholic and said, you know, I regret the ways that I harmed you. I regret the ways that I judged you and tried to change you. That had everything to do with me not loving myself. That wasn't about you. And I felt the toxic bond that had enmeshment that had formed between us. I felt it melt away. And I have since made direct amends with my mom and with many, many others, including that couples therapist that I had wrote a long 3-page letter to, taking her inventory and blaming her. I had written evidence of my harm there, so it was easy to make the amends. In step 10, I try to ask myself at the end of the day, am I living in alignment with what I believe is God's will for me today? And if I am not, then what can I do differently tomorrow? In step 11, I pray and meditate every morning. For me, I have to get on my knees because it helps me feel humble that there is this power that's greater than human power, and I need that power in my life. And my disease lives in my head, and I have to get out of my head, and that's why meditation has been so important, because I need to get into my body. And I've had to learn a new language. I didn't know the language of the heart I had to learn that here. And meditation, prayer and meditation daily has been an important part of that. Right now I'm going through the steps again, and I'm on for a second time, and I'm on step 12, and I'm just kind of immersed in that right now. And I like it. It's a complex step. It says in Paths to Recovery that our whole program can be summed up in the 12th step. My sponsor says the purpose of the 12 steps is to connect me with my higher power. That's the purpose. I think there's a lot of distracting things that in the meetings and who's doing what, and, you know, what meeting is this? And it's really about my connection with my higher power. My higher power knows what's best for me. No one else does. And so it says, I like and encourage to change, that in carrying the message to others, that example isn't the main thing. It's the only thing. I like that. I like those only statements. And so when I had gotten back from the World Service Conference in April this year, it was in New York, and my mom called and she said, let's go to dinner. I'll be in San Francisco. And she says one of her friends is going to join us. So her friend says, you know, what were you doing in New York? And I said, I was at the World Service Conference. And she says, what's that? And I said, it's Al-Anon. And she says, what's that? And I said, well, it helps families and friends of alcoholics the way that AA helps alcoholics get sober. She goes, wow, that sounds amazing. And my mom looked at her lifetime friend and she said, Al-Anon is a life-changing program. My jaw hit the table. And then she said, when John's dad was dying, they told me to go to some Al-Anon meetings. And I went to one, but I didn't like what I heard there. I guess I should have gone to more meetings. Example isn't the main thing, it's the only thing. I can't carry the message to my family, but I know they are watching. Is John any nicer to be around? Is John any happier? How's he's doing a lot of work? What's it doing for him? And so when I had first come into Al-Anon, I was in maybe 3 months, and I got a call from my first partner, the one I left. And he said, can you meet for coffee? And I thought, I wonder what this is about. I had moved out. I was living alone and going to Al-Anon meetings. I had nothing in my life, felt like nothing. But we met, and he started, he seemed different and humble. I'd never seen that before. And he said something about his sponsor, and I said, what sponsor? And he said, oh, I got sober in AA last year. And I started laughing, and I said, you're not going to believe this. I said, I started going to Al-Anon just a few months ago, and that started a new friendship between us, and it grew. And over time, he asked if I would move back, and I talked with my sponsor, and he talked to his. But I did move back in. That was maybe about 13 years ago, and we have a sober home, and we have a loving home. I never had a safe or sober home. There was always an active alcoholic in my life for 41 years. If it wasn't my father, it was my first roommate in college. Then it was all my roommates after college. Then I moved right in with the alcoholic. I always had an active alcoholic home. And at 41, I had that. And we've been repairing our relationship. And as I was working through step 9, earlier this year, I said, well, it says, you know, one of the questions, I can't remember, but I asked him, do you feel I have made amends sufficiently with you? And he said, John, you and I are in the best place in our relationship that we've ever been. Wow. if I didn't ask that question, I really wouldn't have known that that's what he was thinking. I like where our relationship is at today, and it does keep growing and improving. But if we don't have that kind of communication, then how will we ever know? How would I have ever known that my mom didn't ever give up if I hadn't have written that card and communicated? None of these things would have been possible in my recovery if it wasn't for service. How Al-Anon works says service is love in action. And it, I believe that that is true. And Al-Anon has carved out this path for each of us through the 12 steps, through the traditions, and through the concepts of service, so that we can have a life again, so that we can have a spiritual awakening and carry that message to others. I can't believe the life that I get to live today. I couldn't have imagined this life. God has bigger dreams and better dreams than I do. So I'm so grateful to Al-Anon for giving me my family back, for giving me my life back. I don't know why I ended up with an alcoholic father, but I think that, I don't know why I ended up with HIV. I think that God wanted me to learn how to take care of myself. I've been HIV positive for 35 years. You don't live that long if you don't take care of yourself. And I don't know why I ended up with neuropathy. I was very resentful, regretful, and angry about that for a long time. But maybe God just wanted me to slow down because it slowed me down. I think you need to slow down to get these 12 steps. And I don't know why my dad was an alcoholic, why I ended up with an alcoholic father, but maybe alcoholism was what I needed in my life to make me willing to reach for God. Because the truth is that's really all I've ever wanted in my life. Thank you for inviting me here. It's so nice to be with you here and online as well. And thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
So I know one of the ideas for tonight was to give folks an opportunity to ask questions. So this is your chance if you want to write them down. I think that was an option. If you want to stand up and just raise your hand, you can ask it out loud, whatever people are comfortable with. I know that this is a time of a lot of change in Al-Anon, and the World Service Conference theme this year was increasing our recovery through abundance, unity, and understanding. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding I've been noticing around what is happening right now with the changes and transition in Al-Anon. I think it brings up that misunderstanding can create confusion and problems. And so this is a good chance to talk with each other. Hi, Linda.
Hi, my name is Linda. And for me, being in the rooms means a lot. I like to tell my husband I have a hug deficit, because I do. And I told him I need minimum of 3 hugs a day, first thing in the morning when I come home from work and before I go to sleep. But really, I like the hugs I get in Al-Anon in the rooms too. And that sense of, you know, just the meeting after the meeting, the fellowship, and I don't know how I could be helpful or how would, also I'm concerned about the fact that we're not having enough funds raised by selling literature. That's dropped tremendously. The other thing too I'm concerned about is that I went to 11 Service Conference, which is, you know, my husband's in AA sober, and we go together. Before COVID, that hotel was packed. We just went a month ago, and there was about, you know, a very small amount of people attended. Most people are attending online, and I think that's great because it does create a convenience. But it was mentioned that they didn't charge ticket entrance fees to the people who are attending online. And so only the people who attend in person paid to come to the conference. And I feel scared and sad to think that we just don't have enough money or funds to be a self-supporting, sustaining fellowship to have these conferences and stuff. So I don't know, can you speak to that a little bit?
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Linda. It's a good question. I think it's a question that a lot of people have in mind. I think you brought up a lot of topics. I'll try to talk about the financial part first. So it is true that the World Service Office presented a deficit budget for this year in April. It was around $353,000. It has improved by a little over $20,000 since then. And that's due to increased higher than expected forum magazine subscriptions and online mobile app subscriptions. And there was a bump in contributions in June from the special appeal letter. But expenses are also increasing because travel is increasing for WSO staff, which includes the Board of Trustees. And so literature sales are still not back to pre-pandemic levels. And those are the two sources of primary sources of income for Al-Anon World Service, which is contributions and literature sales. So I think it's just important to talk about those things so that members are aware and that they're given the opportunity to participate. I think people will return to in-person when they're comfortable or ready or able, and not all people will be ready or able. So Al-Anon has the 11th tradition, which is that we rely on attraction. So it has to be attractive. I noticed at the May assembly, which was a hybrid assembly, a lot of members said to me afterwards, privately, I wish I had come in person. It looked so great. I'll be there in person in October. So I just know that I'm getting that kind of feedback. So I think it's a process that we're in. There will be one of our past trustees, Norm W. from Arizona, will be at our assembly in October. And he's been asked to share specifically on the topic of transitioning meetings from online back to in person. So that is an opportunity to participate in that conversation. And I just think it's important to talk about the ways that our fellowship, our program has been impacted. You mentioned literature sales, that's one. Contributions has been another. I think certainly newcomers have been impacted. I just don't know if I had come into Al-Anon during the online time, if I would have gotten what I got. I don't know. And then by far, Alateen has paid maybe the biggest price, because right now we have no Northern California Alateen Conference this year for the first time in how many years?
Oh,
Over 40? Over 40. So yeah, over 40 years. And NOCAC, well, if you don't know, it's the glue that holds all the Alateen groups together throughout the year, because the teens go to NOCAC, they get supercharged and pumped with Alateen recovery, and they bring that energy back to the meeting. So then their meeting has attraction, and then that lasts for a few months. And then what they're talking about is the next NOCAC, and that creates a lot of enthusiasm. And I don't know if you can remember being a teenager, but there was nothing better than a weekend out of the house without your parents. And that's what NOCAC gives them, an opportunity to experience some of their autonomy. And it's very attractive to them. And so they're not having that right now. The teens don't, in general, don't like online meetings. This is surprising to adults, because we see the teenagers on their devices so much. But what we've learned, and we knew this even before the pandemic, because there was an Alateen survey. We asked them it was on panel 55, and we're on 61 right now. We asked them, do you want more access to online meetings? And 95% or more said, no, not interested. Like the in-person experience with our friends. So it's like, okay, check. We got that message. So I knew when the pandemic started, I thought, it's not going to be good for Alateen. It was far worse than I could have imagined. I did not know that it would impact Alateen the way it has. It's, people don't understand what service looks like, Alateen service, being a sponsor and an EMEAS, an Al-Anon member involved in Alateen service, because there, no one's been able to see it. They can't see anybody doing it. It's not being talked about in the meetings. So that attraction that I got when I was at 2 years and I saw those people who had been Alateen sponsors, I'm like, why is their recovery like a little different, a little bit better? I want what they have. That's missing. So I would just talk about those aspects. I think that we are in a new era. You know, the electronic era, and it's here to stay. I've seen some of the things that happen in other areas that seem to work. Some assemblies that have returned in person in other areas, they have a registration fee, and if people are if they're doing a hybrid setup, they do same price for everybody, because our events have expenses. That's another reason to encourage members to come in person. We sign a contract with a hotel. That means number of butts in the seats. That means number of room nights sold. That means number of meals sold. If you are able, and I understand and respect, as a person with a disability, as a person with HIV, I respect people's need to be safe. But if you are able and willing to attend in person, you know, the fellowship needs that. Yeah. Okay.
It looks like Jason's hand is up.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you, John, very much for your talk tonight. Very much. I wanted to ask, you know, of course, when COVID began, we all scrambled to have meetings go electronic on Zoom. And then I go to a number of meetings that have gone the hybrid route. But I'm noticing, at least in a couple of the meetings that I've been at now, there's a movement to not have hybrid anymore, and to either split the meeting into a in-person only or an electronic meeting only, because at least in one meeting I was at, it got very, is the word acrimonious, because the people who were doing the hybrid in-person stuff began to feel more resentful at all the work involved in having that happen. I'm wondering if you're noticing a trend among meetings you're going to of hybrid meetings kind of breaking up and not staying hybrid. Is that a trend you're seeing? And if so, is it being done with cordiality, or is it causing a tense breakup, so to speak?
Jason, I'll turn this way so you can see.
Yes, thank you.
Jason, thank you for your question. I can only see you when I look this way. Thank you, actually, for that question. It's an important question. It's hard for me to really say whether that's a trend or not. I don't know if I can accurately or be able to answer that part of the question. But what I can say is that we all have needs, and it is up to us to do what we need to do to take care of ourselves. And if you are a person who needs to be at an in-person meeting to have that medicine that you get at that in-person experience, then by all means, you know, you are encouraged to do that. If you are a person who needs to remain online, then by all means do that. We have spiritual principles in this program, and if you've ever written or called or emailed the WSO with a complaint, then you know what their answer is. Does anybody know what their answer is when you call them with a complaint?
Check the service manual.
That can sometimes be included. Yes, definitely check the service manual. But what they say is talk to each other and reason things out with one another, because the World Service Office is not an authority. You could say that they work for us, the groups. The World Service Office exists as to serve and support the groups. So they are not an authority. Just like the delegate isn't an authority about what the groups do, the delegate serves as a link of communication between the groups and the World Service Office and the World Service Conference. So it's the delegate's job to bring back that information. What I would say to your question is that we are in a transition time. Transitions are slow and transitions are painful. That is true. And things need to just have its time to shake out, and things will sort of, when the dust settles, things will, you know, sort of settle where it needs to be. But I love that in how Al-Anon works, where it says it's not our job to be right, and it's not our job to win. It's our job to do everything we can to heal ourselves and our relationships. So acrimony in an Al-Anon meeting about how we're going to meet is antithetical to the purpose of an Al-Anon meeting. It saddens me to hear it. I have heard it. Yeah. Vic. Okay, I'm going to go to Vic, and then I'll go back to the online question. Do you want to come up?
I think the confusion is when you're in the meetings and the groups are trying to decide if they're going to stay in in-house meeting or the Zoom, and you're supposed to have a group conscience, okay? If you've got a group conscience when 15 people are in Texas and they still want the meeting, and you have 15 in the room, how's that going to work? I mean, you're going to have some confusion. I mean, to me, it's called an informed group conscience. And to me, the honesty is, I hate to be blunt, but find your meeting in Texas. Go to that meeting in Texas. You know, if you want to be in California and go to a meeting, come to California and be in a meeting. That's my frustration. You know, I grew up in this program, and I won't tell you how long I've been around. And I have some opinions about your Alateen, but I'll leave that alone tonight.
Thank you, Vic. Thank you. I appreciate you and love you. I love you. Okay, who's next? Okay, Janie. Hi, Janie.
Yes. Hi, John. Thank you so much for your share. I was engrossed. It was awesome. Okay, Alateen. I'm an Alateen sponsor, and now for 2 years I've been serving in Alateen in San Diego as a sponsor down there. It's been wonderful. I get recertified on the Zoom technical thing that I do my training, my recertification every year. But here is something I've heard recently, and I've heard it before too, is that Alateens are always welcome to come to Al-Anon. Is there any way we can encourage our, our membership to invite, or can you give me any information on how we can do that in a way that might work? Thank you.
Thank you, Janie. It's a good question. It's certainly not a unique question to these times. Haven't we always invited Alateens into the Al-Anon meeting? That's not new. Did they want to come? Given the option for an Alateen meeting or an Al-Anon meeting, where did they want to go? They want to be with their peers. And so I had a teen that I was from my Alateen group. He's 21 or two now. And he was in pain. And he called. And he said, can I come to your Al-Anon meeting? I said, of course. And, he didn't show up. My back is hurting. I was like 21. But another month went by, and then the call again, law of pain. And can I come? And I, of course, here's where it is. I'll meet you there. He did come. Halfway through the meeting, he said, I gotta go. He wasn't relating, I think, is what was happening. We do encourage Alateens to attend Al-Anon, and there are some that it works for, but I think they're the minority from my experience. The majority of them want to be with their peers. But please, by all means, continue to encourage them to Alateen members to attend, because Alateen members are Al-Anon members. Can you repeat the question? Okay, so the question is, what do you do when you have a dynamic where there's a hybrid meeting and the majority of the volunteering for service is occurring with the members who are in the physical meeting, and there's a lack of service participation from the members in the electronic part of the meeting. Okay, well, I also don't think that that's unique to these times. There's always, there's some meetings that I've been to where never a problem to fill service positions, and they're kind of lively. And but then there's some meetings where it's all, why is it always a struggle to fill service positions in some meetings? It's just sort of like that. I've noticed that for many, many years. Your question to me is, what do you do? Our spiritual principles don't change. Maybe I have a question for you. Is that working for you, or is this not working for you? Okay, so the question is now more focused on not all service positions, but on the technical support aspect of the in-person part. And I mean, we have rotation of service. So there has to be, okay, so I just try to equate everything to before the pandemic. So what did we do before the pandemic? If people refused to fill a service position, then that's not me, that meeting isn't self-supporting. And if it's continuing that it's not being filled, then those types of meetings generally don't last. Oh, thank you, Lee. So Lee's question is, how has delegate service aided my recovery? I can't begin. It opens so many doors. I feel so grateful. If you have an opportunity to do service in this program, do it. I never felt isolated during the pandemic. That's the first thing I'll say. I never felt isolated. I was involved, engaged, busy. Al-Anon supported me through the pandemic. It has given me the opportunity to understand the program. Al-Anon is a huge organization, and I'm able to see the larger picture. I understand what that concept that Kathleen read tonight, I understand what concept 8 means, that the Board of Trustees has delegated authority for routine management of Al-Anon World Service to the Executive Committee. I understand what that means. I understand who those people are in those roles. And I've seen them, I see them rotate through. I understand why it's like that, so that our program can function and we can accomplish more. So I'm able to translate that into my personal life. I understand the importance of the spiritual principle of delegated responsibility and delegated authority. I get to connect with you more. This is the part that I love the most, to be able to meet with Al-Anon members throughout all of Northern California, but also I have Al-Anon friends in every state now and each province in Canada. When we met at the conference this year, it was in 100% in-person event. We had been working together for the past year and a half exclusively online. So none of us had ever met each other in person. I mean, some people might have known each other, you know, in states that were close, but when we gathered for the first time, it was so joyous. It was so, the love that is our Al-Anon program just started flowing. I mean, imagine your friend that you love, that you haven't been able to see for the past year and a half, 2 years, and you finally get together and see each other. The level of gratitude was so high. The appreciation for our program, how hard people work. If you only knew how hard so many people work to keep this amazing program going. It's really impressive and it's really inspiring. So it fills me.
All of us, let's give John one more hand here. Thank you for everything, John.